That is going to make an awesome after show.
It's not really, because it's going to be just a white dude bitching and moaning about his expensive car. It's going to be a terrible after show.
And we're going to keep it in, and people are going to like it. And the one or two people that don't like it have long since stopped listening.
Fair enough. All right, so people have suggested that this Phantom version of the Mac, which includes an ARM coprocessor, if you will, maybe that's used for power nap. I still am skeptical that would be a reasonable use case, but be that as it may, there people have used an example of apparently there's something in the PlayStation 4, which apparently is a console that people apparently play video games with. I didn't realize that was still a thing. But anyway, it has a rest mode that I guess works similarly. Right, John?
Yeah, so the last show we were talking about, the ARM CPU actually being able to function and do useful work when the Intel CPU is off, which would mean that the ARM CPU would need access to all the same stuff, you know, all the I/O and networking and all the other stuff, regardless of what software it runs, whether it runs just, you know, a bunch of Apple software that Apple supplies as part of the OS, or whether third parties can ship ARM compiled binaries to it, that it would be a full-fledged CPU able to do useful work. And I was saying how that is pretty complicated if the only benefit you're getting out of it is we can do power nap on the ARM CPU instead of the Intel CPU. And it remains to be seen if the next item follow-up we have some more suggestions of things this thing could do to justify that complexity. But the PS4 is actually an example of this actual thing in practice, because the PS4 is an x86 CPU. And when you put it into rest mode, it's basically like the thing is turned off. The fans are off and everything. Like, it doesn't make any noise. It just sits there. But it's not completely off. And what it does in this mode is it will, like, download giant updates to your games. It will charge your controllers. It will, you know, do other sort of background tasks that don't require it to be on, but still mean that it's doing useful work. It will do, obviously, with downloading, it's using stuff over the network. And in that rest mode, it's according to this feedback we've gotten, which I'm perfectly willing to believe, although I haven't looked into it extensively, it's not using the Intel CPU. It is using a separate ARM chip just to do this stuff. And that's an example of an x86 and an ARM CPU in a box. And when the x86 CPU is turned off, the ARM CPU is able to do all that stuff. It's able to do, you know, manipulate stuff on the hard drive. It's able to use networking. It's able to do all the, you know, the things. And that is an additional complexity that is worth it for the PS4, because it is fixing all the sins of the PS3. That every time you wanted to turn the thing on and play a game, you had to download 50 updates. And it's like, why didn't you do that for the 12 hours I wasn't home, PS3? It wouldn't even charge your controllers when it was turned off, the PS3. You plugged them in, you know, well, I'm playing the game, I'll plug them in. Like, it's the worst. So the PS4 fixes all this. And so it's an obvious win on the console. And it's, you know, it's down to the instruction set exactly what they were talking about for this rumored Apple laptop. Question remains, is that additional complexity, and I'm sure it's additional complexity, worthwhile for a Mac? And so we had one other suggestion for something that the ARM CPU could do that is useful, that doesn't require third-party developers to make extensions that with ARM code compiled to it and ship it off there and do all sorts of stuff like that. David Boroditsky suggested good old photos and face recognition. You know, like when you first get your Mac, or at any point, like it's wandering over your photos, finding all the faces, and or doing the image recognition nowadays, like figuring out everything that's a house or whatever, so you can do searches later. That would be a perfect thing to do when your Mac is in rest mode or asleep or whatever, and it would require maybe networking access, depending on how much cloud stuff they do for the image recognition, but certainly it would require disk access. Is that worth the added complexity of making a Mac that can run either on an x86 CPU or on an ARM CPU, depending on what mode it's in? Maybe.
I don't know. That, first of all, like the photo recognition thing, like I hope they fix that in this fall's software updates. Like, make that sync already. Everything else about photos syncs. Like, the fact that every device has to do that is not only a terrible hack with awkward results sometimes, but it just destroys the battery life and performance of computers and iOS devices for the first like 3 days that you get them, and that's just a bad initial user experience for everybody.
But somebody's got to do it. Like, I know people might have multiple devices, but one of the devices has to do it, and that device is the victim, no matter. It's great that it'll be shared, like, I'll just, you know, but I would imagine for a lot of people, like, the phone would be the victim, because that's where they take the pictures. And who knows if people even have photos syncing on their Mac. Like, I feel bad that any device has to be subject to this. I mean, the only, they could change the policy by saying, we won't do image recognition unless nobody's using the computer, nobody's using the device and it's plugged in. Like, basically only do it when you're sleeping and it's plugged in.
Well, they already attempt to do that. Like, it does stop when you are unplugged on the laptops most of the time. However, it takes forever, to the point where, like, you never know when you plug it in. Like, is it about to spin the fan up? And then when you unplug it, like, how long will it take before it pauses? It uses the discrete GPU, which exacerbates any kind of GPU sticking on bugs. It's just kind of a mess. On iOS, it's even worse, because then, like, your phone gets really hot for, like, the first while that you have it. You're like, why is my phone so hot? Is something wrong with it? Is it going to catch fire? Like, it's just really inelegant and really sets up very bad user experiences for anybody who's setting up an iOS or Mac device that isn't their first one ever. And that's, they really, really need to address that in this year's updates. Like, that cannot wait.
Yeah. So I'm not sure it would be better if instead it did it while it was asleep, because obviously it will take way longer to do it while it's asleep. Only Apple knows for sure. But, like, what are the usage patterns for devices that are plugged in, not iOS devices, because they're never asleep awake. Like, when the screen's off, basically, that's a, you know, asleep. Like, when they're plugged in overnight and charging, that's when they should be doing their photo stuff, if that's the only device. But for Macs, I don't know what the defaults are, but I imagine if you walk away from your Mac, it'll be on for some period of time, and then I think the default is to go to sleep after, like, not that long of a time. And if you can't do any photo recognition stuff in the background in sleep mode normally, like, if power nap doesn't do any of it now, that's all wasted time. So the only time your Mac has to do photos is when it's unattended, is like the 1 hour between when you stop using it and when it goes to sleep, according to the default energy saver settings or whatever. Whereas it could have had 12 hours just plinking away with this little ARM CPU. So maybe that would help a little bit. But again, I have to, you know, the complexity of having a second full-fledged CPU with access to all the same things as the Intel CPU is significant. And I'm still, so far, I'm still on the page that it's much smarter to use that CPU for auxiliary functions that have to do with the hardware. Like I said last time, a proximity sensor, camera, microphone, you know, sort of like a glorified M1 or M7? What was that, the original motion detecting, step counting thing in the iPhone?
Was it the M8?
No. Still, we got BMW on the brain. M7.
There, yeah. You go.
It's the 1M, because the M1 was a totally different car. Anyway.
Yeah.
Having dedicated hardware for functions related to the hardware. And that's perfect for a little CPU. And again, and the only reason we're talking about this at all is it's already there to run the touch bar. It's already there. And so you're just saying, how can I get more bang for my buck from this thing that I already have to put in? It's not like we're looking to throw a bunch of new chips into the thing. It's already in these laptops. So, I believe that a next version or a version after that of this, they'll find new things to do with the chip. They should, because they're paying for the chip and it's there. And when it's not doing anything fancy on the screen, give it something else to do. They have good ARM chips and they have a good OS to run on them. So why waste it?
Speaking of face recognition, Windows Hello, whatever that may be, does some really weird and fancy stuff with their face recognition.
Yeah, I made a joke about face recognition not being good for security, because someone just prints out a picture of your face and holds it up and then they unlock your laptop. Didn't specifically say that that was a vulnerability of Windows Hello, because they didn't know much about it, but many people wrote in to say that Windows Hello actually uses depth maps so that you can't just hold up a picture, because it wants something that not only looks like your face but is contoured and shaped like your face. So people would have to make basically a mannequin of your face instead of just a picture, which is harder. And then the faces versus fingerprints thing, because a lot of people bring up, like, well, it's just like fingerprints. Like, people can lift your fingerprints pretty easily. I feel like it's still, the apt comparison is local versus remote exploit. Local exploits, like, there's a million of them. Basically, if someone has physical access to your computer, in most cases, game over as far as security for a variety of reasons. For fingerprints, they need to have physical access to either you or something you've touched to lift your fingerprints. And there's been many demonstrations on the web, like, oh, you can lift someone's fingerprint and you can unlock their iPhone, because, you know, fingerprints are just a series of ridges and we can get them out and make a little plastic mold of it and you're gone. Right now, usually you can't get fingerprints from a normal photo of people. Like if you're walking down the street and someone snaps a picture of you, they can't lift your fingerprints from that picture. Or if they Google you, they probably won't find close-up pictures of your fingerprints or anything you've touched at a resolution where they can lift your fingerprints from. But for most people, you can find plenty of pictures of their face. And you could fairly, not easily, but much more easily, remotely, without ever being anywhere near that person or anything they've touched, reproduce their face in a 3D manner from a series of photos that are taken of a whole bunch of different angles, and use a 3D printer to make a little mold, and then print out a picture of their face and slap it onto the mannequin, and it fools the depth sensors, and it fools the camera, and you've unlocked their thing with their face. Again, this is kind of like Mission Impossible, whatever stuff. If someone is this determined to attack you, it's probably much better just to call you and tell you they're from Microsoft and they want to reset your password, because that's a much easier way to get into your stuff. But thinking about this and how easy it is to pull your fingerprints versus make a 3D model of your face versus whatever, it has reminded me once again of the trouble with all biometric security, which you see in like the future, you know, sci-fi movies. They're always putting their hands on things or doing retina scans, or we're living in the future now with fingerprints. I use my fingerprint to unlock my phone all the time. I love it. It's awesome. But the trouble with all biometrics is if they are compromised in any way, if people have your fingerprints or have a nice 3D mold of your face, you can't change those things. You can't say, well, I'm going to use a new set of fingerprints. Always rotate your fingerprints. Don't use the same fingerprints in multiple sites, guys. Your fingerprints are your fingerprints. And for the most part, your face is your face. So once compromised, they are compromised forever. You can't use your fingerprint. If the whole world has high-res images of your fingerprints are useless. Never mind that in this country, anyway, law enforcement can make you put your stupid finger on the thing anyway. But just in general, biometrics, they're unlike passwords that you can change and rotate or whatever. You can't change them. Even your retinas. If you do a retina scan and someone has like a detailed map of your retina and makes a little fake eyeball with your retina scan, you can't use retina scans anymore. It's bad. And if it became commonplace, it's the definition of repeating your password. You only have 10 fingers, right? Then you have a different finger on each secure thing. So in general, biometrics are a great convenience. But if we, in sci-fi movies of our youth anyway, they're always presented as a much more secure way, like, haha, you can't get in because you don't have my eyeball or my finger. And then didn't take long for the movies to shift into gouging people's eyeballs out and cutting off their hands to get their fingerprints, which is another downside of biometrics. But in general, I think biometrics are settling in to be the casual convenience feature. Like, it's the reason I unlock my phone with it, because who wants to type in some big long password every time you unlock your phone? But not for increased security. We're still stuck with, for now, big giant passwords and multiple factors.
I love that ripping out somebody's eyes and cutting off their fingers is described by you, John, as a downside.
I mean, it is.
It's a pretty significant downside in my book, though.
No one's going to do that unless you're in a sci-fi movie, like, because no one cares that much about your crap. And again, there are much easier ways to get at your crap. Like just forcing you to put your finger on it because you're not a big tough guy. But in the movies, to get into the evil villain's lair, you cut off the guy's hand, cut off the henchman's hand, and you just shove it on the panel.
Didn't Tom Cruise's character do that in Minority Report?
He got new eyes.
Oh, it's been done so many times, so many times.
We are brought to you this week by SetApp, the revolutionary new service for discovering and using the best apps for your Mac. What if there was a way to know that every app you install was safe, always updated, and of the highest quality? That is what SetApp is here to do. SetApp is developed by MacPaw. They've actually been a previous sponsor on this show with the Clean My Mac line of products, and they've created many successful apps for the Mac. They've been Mac developers themselves for years, and they know the market really well. They know what customers want, and they know what developers want. Developers want a way to make consistent, stable revenue from their products without having to mess with the complexity of things like upgrade pricing and trials and everything else. And customers want to know that they can go to a storefront or a collection that has the best apps. They don't have to like worry about looking through a million reviews and trying to figure out which apps have hidden in-app purchases or ads or anything like that. They just want someone else to pick for them, to curate this collection for them, and to give them what's best. MacPaw has done this with SetApp. SetApp gives you easy access to their curated library of quality Mac apps like Ulysses, Rapid Weaver, Clean My Mac, Eltima Player, and many, many more. And you get all this as a user for just a flat monthly subscription fee. You get access to the entire library, no matter how many of those apps you use. You can use all of them if you want to, and you just pay this low monthly rate. It's a huge library of prime Mac apps that you get for one fixed rate per month with no ads, no paid upgrades. When a new version comes out, you just get it. They just give you the best collection of helpful, useful, high-quality Mac software right at your fingertips. Try it today at setapp.com. Once again, that's setapp, S-E-T-A-P-P, setapp.com to try out setapp, see for yourself. Thank you very much to setapp for sponsoring our show.
All right, so there's been a little bit of sort of kind of back and forth between our show and one host across two other shows, which is a friend of the show, Mike Hurley. He has talked on his two podcasts, Upgrade and Connected, about some arguments or counter-arguments about whether or not the iPad is worth Apple's attention. And you really should listen to both Upgrade and Connected in general, but particularly the latest episodes, and we'll put links in the show notes. I'm going to try to unfairly summarize Mike's points and then...
I can't wait to hear this.
Yeah. And then Marco can add his two cents about all this. What I got from what Mike said was, hey, if you look at modern iPads and modern Macs, where you define modern slightly arbitrarily, but basically can run the most recent versions of iOS and macOS. I don't remember the exact numbers, but you know, modern Macs by that definition go back like between 5 and 10 years, and modern iPads go back, I think, around 5 years, something like that. The particular numbers don't really matter that much. The conclusion, though, that Mike came to was, hey, if you look at the sales and thus assumed install base of modern Macs and modern iOS devices, or excuse me, iPads, there are like twice as many iPads as there are Macs. So if there's that many iPads in the wild, shouldn't that be where Apple puts most of its attention? Because presumably all of these iPads are still in use, and presumably at least a subset of these owners, you know, iPad owners, are using them for, and I'm doing scare quotes here, work stuff. So shouldn't that be where Apple puts all of its attention, or maybe not all, but a lot of its attention? And that's a super, super, super summarized version. Again, listen to Connected and Upgrade, actually in the reverse order, listen to Upgrade first. But anyway, listen to them to get the longer versions. But that's kind of what I got from it. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, and this was in response to what a lot of people were talking about after the earnings came out, 2 weeks ago now, about how iPad sales continued to drop. And many people commented on this with theories, myself included, both on my blog, and then we talked about it on the show last week. And, you know, many, many people, every time there's quarterly earnings that come out and it shows that the iPad sales are going down, which has happened a lot in the last few years, everyone has these theories about, well, here's why the iPad has failed or is failing, or you can't get real work done on it, or whatever else. And so if you are an iPad pro heavy user, like Mike and Federico and some of our other friends are, then this makes sense to be defensive about, because it's very hard to separate out these arguments into like individual things to talk about. A lot of times people are arguing past each other because they're not quite hearing what the other argument was, or they're responding more to a general feeling or to a general kind of trend of where the commentary is or has been, rather than what somebody actually said or what people are actually trying to figure out. And there's nuance to all this stuff. So part of what Mike and Jason on Upgrade were responding to was not just what we said, but I think a lot of it was based on us and what we said and what I wrote in my blog post about what if the iPad isn't the future of computing. And so I did want to address this hopefully briefly here. And I'm working with Mike. We actually might do a little special with just me and Mike arguing about it maybe next week sometime. But we'll...
Do I get not to participate in that? Because I'm right about everything, and you guys just have to argue about which one is going to be more wrong.
Yikes.
I didn't listen to these episodes, but it seems like it was like Mike versus Marco. But like I said stuff too. Didn't anyone disagree with the stuff that I said?
You got hit too. Don't worry. You and I were kind of lumped in together. Anyway, so
that's unfair. Now that's ridiculous.
I knew that would get you. Anyway, so here's my actual position here. Obviously, people are getting real worked out on iPads. Not every iPad owner, of course, but as Mike accurately pointed out, not every Mac is sold and used to do, quote, real work, whatever that means. Mike's main point was also that, you know, like the iPad, obviously, even with the downward slope of its sales curve, is still selling like 2 to 2.5 times unit sales of what Macs are selling. And there are still way more iPads out there than Macs. And so therefore, this is a serious platform. And I'm not arguing against any of that, actually. My main argument with my post, and hopefully if I express it properly last week, is that the iPad is presented in so many views, both from Apple and from analysts and fans, as, quote, the future of computing. And what I interpret that to mean is a replacement, ultimately, or largely a replacement for the PC and the Mac. What we're mostly seeing is that, you know, PCs have been a little bit contracting for a while, but Mac sales have been pretty solid. The rise of the iPad over, it's been 7 years now, and it's been popular the whole time. So, like, it's selling a lot. The iPad's selling a lot. But during that entire rise, sales of Macs haven't gone down. So if the iPad were really, like, the future of computing, in quotes, and I'm doing finger quotes here, sorry, in the way that means replacing PCs and Macs for a lot of people, I think the numbers are showing otherwise in that. I made the case last week that for a lot of people, if you're going to choose between only being able to afford or only wanting to own either an iPad or a computer, they're still picking that computer. I think the sales show that. And there's lots of reasons, as we got into last week, about why that might be. You know, things like the limitations of doing things on the iPad and how many limitations you have there versus what limitations tend to be on PCs and you know, differences in usability and everything. You know, we argued about this, so I'm not going to repeat the whole thing. All this is not to say that you can't get work done on an iPad or that iPads are only for consumption. I never said that. This is also all not to say that nobody is replacing their PC or Mac with an iPad. I didn't say that either. But I think very clearly my argument here that I'm clarifying now again, my argument is that on a large scale, it doesn't appear that tablets are replacing PCs. And the Windows world is a little bit messier because they kind of have these combo things. But on the Apple side, I think it's very, very clear that the iPad is not replacing the Mac. It seems that most people who buy the iPad are buying it as the third device. However they order it in their minds, they still have a phone and a computer. And the iPad is added to that mix. Again, not everybody, not all iPads, but this is added to the mix for so many of these people. And so while everyone can name someone who got an iPad and doesn't use their computer anymore, a lot of people also use computers and don't buy iPads. So I think the sales reflect the reality here. The iPad, like so many things in technology, has not destroyed what came before it. It has added to it. And so in a world where it is one of many devices that people use to get computing on, as opposed to the device that is replacing the computer, I worry about the direction that Apple is taking between the Mac and the iPad, because it sure looks like, from Apple's point of view, and we'll get to this crazy Slashdot rumor in a little bit, but it sure looks like, for the most part, what we see from Apple is that the Mac is kind of like, as I said last week, it's kind of like in maintenance mode. It seems like they're not really putting a lot of like huge effort into like moving the Mac paradigm forward. It seems like they consider the Mac basically done, and they're doing fairly minor things to it. Touch bar hardware engineering aside, yes, okay, but the software model seems like it's been fairly minor and not seeing a lot of meaningful changes or engineering effort put into it. Could be wrong, but this is what we're seeing from the outside. Whereas the iPad, if that were to be the future of computing, then that needs more investment. What we're seeing instead is that that's not the future of computing, and Apple's kind of neglecting both of these platforms. But that's a story for another day, I guess. But I just wanted to clarify my argument on this is not that the iPad is useless or dead or not possible to get work done on. It's simply that it is showing itself through sales to be, in reality, a third device for a lot of people and to not be replacing the Mac.
While you were talking about that, I was thinking about... offhand comment, I think it was in the last show, that Apple doesn't make best anymore. And thinking about Mac sales, not that they're declining, but as the Mac has become over many years, proportionally less of what Apple sells, mostly because of the iPhone, honestly, you know, because they sell a bazillion iPhones, right? But even, you know, the iPad has pointed out that sells as much or more than the Mac these days. To go back to our favorite well, the good old car analogy, in the car world, if you sell a small number of cars and you are a going concern in the car business, chances are good that the small number of cars you sell are extreme in some way. No one sells a small number of Toyota Camrys. Like, you can't run a car business by selling 5,000 Toyota Camrys a year. That's not a thing, right? But you can sell 5,000 Ferraris a year and be okay. You can sell 5,000 Humvees maybe and be okay, or that's a bad example because that's GM. But anyway, if you sell in small volume, you specialize. And very often you charge tons of money, like way out of proportion to the quality of the car that you're selling, you know, Jaguar or whatever. Sorry, you know, that's maybe that's not true these days. I know they're better. Anyway, if the Mac, again, not low volume, but proportionally lower volume, if the Mac becomes the minor player in the world of the iPhone, which is the Toyota Camry, right? And maybe even the iPad is selling more than it, you know, on an ongoing basis. That would be the perfect time for them to look at that line and say, well, who is still buying Macs? Why would someone want a Mac over an iPad? Well, they have more demanding needs and more sophisticated tasks. Go back to the old world Apple, which was perfectly willing to have a machine that could be configured with an obscene amount of RAM, with a ridiculous number of the most expensive CPUs, with a very large hard drive and a very big, hot, expensive GPU, and overcharge for all of it. That's the old Apple way. Make a machine that I can configure to be as much as an Apple Watch edition. Right? Should be able to configure, you used to even with the old 2013 Mac Pro, a $15,000, $20,000 Mac. It's not worth that much money. It's like it's overpriced in the same way that a Ferrari is not worth that much more than a Corvette that has almost the same performance. But for people in certain markets, whether it's because you need the absolute biggest best and you're willing to pay for it, like it's a blip on your radar, or just because you want a Ferrari because you think it's cool, as your volumes get lower in proportion to the rest of your business, that becomes a way to extract more money from this product line. And so it seems that if they are losing interest in the Mac, I wish they would have enough interest to say, can't we fleece those people? Because at this point, like, I'm begging to be fleeced. Can't we, you know, like, how...
Have you priced out a Touch Bar MacBook Pro by any chance, John?
I know. Like, I mean, that's a thing, too. But, like, it's still within the realm of reason. Like, you can't even get it with 32 gigs RAM, right? Like, and if there are people who have those demands, like, there's nowhere to go in the Mac world for them. And, like, regardless of where we want to draw the line between... Where is the line between people who really need a personal computer style thing and people who need an iPad and people who just need a phone? Like, there's a continuum there. But at a certain point, like, we all agree that the Mac is at the one end of that spectrum, right? It's not, no one's arguing that, like, the Mac is in between the iPad or the phone or something. It is one end of that spectrum. You just need to extend that line out and make sure that if someone is forced into a Mac or has to use a Mac because of their work, that they can go all the way up and, you know, because it's a low volume relative to the phone market, charge tons of money, get super high margins, maybe be less into the $500 increases on your laptop model, which is more of a mainstream thing, and just put all that money into, I don't know, like a Mac that's for professionals. Like, you could shorten the name, but whatever. I know we're going in circles here, but I was just...
The sad part is they have been doing that to the Mac Pro. Every Mac Pro generation is more expensive than the last one.
I know, but they didn't give you one with two CPUs in it, right? And then they stopped.
They still raised the price. Years, right?
I know. But like, it just seems like it's frustrating when at any price you can't throw your money at Apple and say, just give me as much RAM as will physically fit in the machine because I'm doing some weird application and I don't care how much it costs. And it's like, nope, not... not interested in selling you that. And you should be, because it's a good way to make money off suckers like us.
And also, and to bring it back a little bit just to the iPad discussion, I did want to also mention a great post that our friend David Sparks made over at Mac Sparky about his interpretation. He is also a very like iPad Pro user, and his interpretation basically of trying to explain away the iPad sales dip is, in short, I hope I'm summarizing this accurately, in short, that basically most people aren't pushing their iPad hardware. Like, that's why so many people are able, even people who have decided to make the iPad a part of their life or a part of their workflow or both, they're still perfectly okay using like a 4-year-old iPad. And the main reason why that he's saying, which I think is right on, is that they're just not pushing it hard enough, because what people do on iPads, what the software does, what is possible to do well on it, is usually pretty light workload kind of stuff. It isn't that the hardware is not getting better. The hardware is getting way better. But just what most people are doing on the iPad doesn't need better hardware. And that the blame for that and the duty to fix that or to try to push that forward mostly lands on Apple. Because a lot of that has to do with the OS and the way it's structured and the various limitations. A lot of that has to do with the app ecosystem, which much of that is on Apple to try to fix or to enable fixes to happen. We've seen this theme from a lot of iPad users' responses over the last 2 weeks to this. People love the iPad. People want to use it for more. They want to be able to do more of their work on it if they can't currently do all of it on it. But iOS needs to move forward in a way that lets people get more work done more efficiently. I mean, there are so many really basic things that we consider basic from like the PC era, of just things like, you know, managing like multiple emails and attachments and, you know, like moving photos around, moving documents around, like things that are very hostile to do on iOS, that are very clunky, or sometimes even just impossible without crazy, you know, hacks, or sometimes just outright impossible. Simple stuff like moving media around and dealing with people's files. Like, iOS really fights people a lot. Basic multitasking stuff, the multitasking implementation now is very limited and could really use some enhancement. And whether that's coming down the road this year or not, we'll see. I hope it does. But the point is, there's still tons of room to improve iOS on the iPad. And I hope Apple tries to do that in some way, because tons of people want that. And it just seems like it seems like regardless of which side of the future of computing you fall on, whether you think it's the iPad or the Mac, it seems like there's plenty to complain about Apple neglecting your platform either way. I hope Apple cares enough about the actual future of computing to invest very heavily in at least one of these platforms, because it seems right now that the Mac is in maintenance mode indefinitely, and the iPad gets occasional updates from iOS when it's convenient for them. We are sponsored this week by Betterment, investing made better. To learn more, visit betterment.com/ATP and get up to 6 months of no fees. It is never too early to start saving for retirement or your other financial goals. Betterment helps you manage your investments with the same strategies that financial advisors use with clients who have millions of dollars, but brought to everybody at a much lower cost. The financial services industry has embraced technology and innovation through the creation of automated investing. This means that you keep more of your money with fees that are a fraction of what you could pay for traditional financial services. And Betterment is the largest independent automated investing service out there, managing more than $5.5 billion for over 180,000 customers. You might have heard about them in the press. They've recently been talked about in the Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg, and TechCrunch. And with Betterment, excess cash your investments generate is automatically reinvested, so every dollar you invest is put to work, and your portfolio is automatically rebalanced as needed. Investing involves risk. To learn more, visit betterment.com/ATP, and you can get up to 6 months of no fees. That's betterment.com/ATP. Betterment, investing made better.
You know, on the idea that the iPads, like, people keep using them because it still does what they want it to do, even though they could buy a much better one, I think is another situation where Apple probably has data about this. But trying to think about it anecdotally, there's two things that come to mind immediately that make you buy a new whatever. One is the usual tractor of software, basically, if you have a vibrant software ecosystem, eventually your old phone doesn't run the cool new app that all your friends are talking about. So the more vibrant the ecosystem is, the more apps take advantage of new hardware or are being dragged along by the platform by like not supporting 32-bit apps anymore or whatever, you know. The more that is a thing, it will make you say, oh, I don't like my phone anymore because all my friends are using App X and I can't use that because it says it doesn't run on my phone or something, right? So software ecosystem, which again is lacking on the iPad, like there is more of that on the phone than there is on the iPad in terms of social pressure and software, you know, action in the software market to publicly belong. And the second one, and this is where Apple would have the data, is how many people replace their phones because they break them? I see a lot of broken phones. And I see fewer broken iPads. I do see cracked iPads. You see them in airports and stuff. But I also see kids in airports with iPads dropping them like they're a juice box. And they just bounce in the giant rubbery case they're in, right? So I'm going to say probably, percentage-wise, phones and their lives because they break more often than iPads, just based on my personal experience and anecdotally. But again, Apple would know because they probably, in all these surveys, say, why are you buying a new phone? It seems to me that those two tractors are making the phone replacement cycle. Notice I didn't list as one of the things that's making people replace their phones is that their phone feels slow. In general, I think iPhones aren't like Windows computers where you use them for 2 years and they're so crapped up that you just need to get a new one. Again, this is based on my experience and talking to other people. That doesn't happen with phones as much. I'm not saying it doesn't happen at all. Sometimes your phone does get slow and, you know, I upgraded the OS and now my phone feels slow. And that is another factor in it. But I feel like it is far behind software ecosystem pressuring you into upgrading your phone and just plain dropping it. And if none of those things are true for the iPad, then it is protected. And it kind of makes me fear for the day when Apple makes an iPhone that you can drop all day long and it never breaks. Will the phone suddenly become like the iPad? If this theory is correct, that you know, the people aren't buying new iPads because the one they have is working just fine. I think people's phones would be working just fine if there wasn't some new app they wanted to play and they didn't keep dropping them. Maybe I'm overestimating the dropping, and maybe I notice cracks too much because I'm always amazed at the vast percentage of people I see, like on the train or whatever, just swiping their thumbs along totally shattered phones, you know, yep. iOS or not, because people drop them and they're made of glass and it's a problem. So I don't know. We really need to get product marketing from Apple on the show now that we're mad with power and say, what are your percentages of why wow. do people replace their phones? Is it because they have an Android phone and it's getting old and slow? Is it because they dropped their old one, or is it because they want to play a new game?
I first of all, that's okay. That'll be question number one for when we get Phil. Well, question number two. Question number one will be about the Mac Pro.
Oh, no. I have many other questions earlier in the queue. We may never get to that one. Sorry, folks.
That's fair. But I do think you are underestimating how many people replace their phone because it's old and slow. Because
do you think it's just OS upgrades? Like, yeah. I brought that up, and I have heard that from a lot of people, and it is a real thing. But I was going to say no one's forcing you to upgrade your phone, but Apple's pretty pushy these days, aren't they?
Yeah, Apple really, really pushes the upgrade pretty hard. And sometimes like an app, a critical app for people will require it. So that kind of forces them to.
I mean, they push you on the iPad too. Like I have had iPads that I regret upgrading the OS for because they're just so old and you upgrade to the very last. I'm like, oh, I should have stayed one version back. So why wouldn't that make people replace their iPads in the same way?
Well, that's a good question worth thinking about. I think one of the reasons for that, maybe one of the biggest reasons for that, is the types of apps that you use on the iPad versus the types of apps that you use on the phone. And like, is there an app that's pushing you to upgrade or not? On the iPad, I think the data shows that despite the community of people who get a lot of work done on the iPad, a lot of iPad users are using it mainly for video watching, web browsing, and email, you know, Facebook, like the basic like email, web, video kind of workflow. And for that, probably nothing's really going to push you to really upgrade your OS. Like, you can still use Apple's Mail app in whatever OS you have. You can still use the web browser. You can probably, like, I would imagine, like, Facebook and Netflix and stuff probably keep their minimum version pretty low.
Well, they'll upgrade the OS, but doesn't matter if you upgrade the OS. If you're just using it to play video, it really doesn't matter exactly how clunky the animation is on Springboard when you launch the Netflix app. All you care about is once the video starts playing, it's fine.
That's fair. But anyway, regardless, I think the way most iPads are used it probably has a slower upgrade cycle from the software side simply because they're not often using a lot of apps that require the newest version of the OS. Whereas on the phone, you have a lot more like, you know, new games that come out, new cutting edge apps that come out, that usually come out on the phone first or only, and you have more early adopters using it. It seems like there's like more driving that. But also, you know, just like there's like this consistent narrative with the iPad that explains a lot of this that is probably correct, and there is some data to back it up, that basically, while you can get work done on it, a lot of people do use it for mostly consumption. That's not a judgment. That's just what people do. That's also true of computers. That's also true of phones. However, that is true of iPads, and that people's needs on iPads are fairly simple most of the time. Whoever's fault that is doesn't really matter. The point is people do pretty simple things on iPads most of the time.
You know, it's only one data point, but I feel like it's relevant. The aforementioned iPad 3 that we had after we stopped using it because we found it to be too old, it was collecting dust for months. And then just a couple months back, I had you know, reset it all, and I had my dad bring it to my grandparents. They live in Pennsylvania. I'm in Virginia. And although they come down from time to time, we haven't been up there in a long time. And, you know, they're not that young at this point because I'm turning 35 pretty soon. And these are my grandparents. But we gave them this iPad 3 mostly so they could FaceTime with us and Declan and, you know, I guess my parents from time to time as well. From what I understand, they were beyond overjoyed to have received it, not only because of FaceTime, but because it's a much easier device for them to use than their PC. And I think it's a reasonably modern PC, but they were overjoyed to receive an iPad 3 late in 2016. When was the iPad 3 new? Like 2012 or something like that? Probably before that, actually.
2012.
It was it 2012? Okay. Mm-hmm. So they were beyond excited to receive this old device, which for them is more than enough. Now, obviously, they have nothing to compare to. Obviously, in a perfect world, I'm sure they would prefer a brand new one. But for someone who hadn't had one before, it was way more than enough. And not every iPad user is going to be like that. And I'm sure that there's tons of iPad users that upgrade regularly that are not using it for work. They just really love the iPad. But to speak of the longevity of the iPad, this is a device that's, you know, nearly 5 years old now that brought genuine joy to their household when they received it.
Well, because that's the thing. Like, this is why old iPads are so useful and so many of them are still in use, because most people's needs are pretty low end. Most people just want a thing that they can browse the web and send emails and see Facebook on. Like, that's pretty much what most people do with any of their computing devices, phone, laptop, or tablet. And so this device is delightful for that. I think that doesn't preclude, you know, people doing really work on it. And also my theory that I'm putting forth with these sales graphs, that like this is mostly just additive to the world of technology. I mean,
there aren't any real answers here. Like, the data that we have is shallow and we have to extrapolate a lot from it. And so because of that, there's so much judgment involved and there's no clear right or wrong. And I think that's why we're going to talk about it in bits across 17 different podcasts for a little while. But yeah, so let's talk about something that's indisputably awesome.
We are brought to you this week by Squarespace. Start building your website today at squarespace.com and enter offer code ATP at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace's platform is incredibly powerful, but it's so easy to use. You can make a beautiful website with no time at all. You can take like less than an hour and see what everything it can do. You don't even have to pay because you can start a free trial. And when you do want to pay, use code ATP, of course. But you don't even have to pay. You can see what it is without ever giving them a credit card. You can get a free trial site. You can build out what you want to see. And you can see for yourself how incredibly good it is. I'll tell you what. Once you've made a site with Squarespace, you will wonder why anybody does it any other way. Because most other ways to make websites are way more complicated, way more time-consuming, much harder to support over time. And people ask us to make websites all the time. You know, people who listen to this show, probably a lot of you, have people in your life who ask you to make websites for them. You don't want to support that. You don't want to do that. You don't want to have to like patch that or upgrade that or deal with them whenever their you know server goes down or whatever else. You want someone else to take care of that, and Squarespace can do that. Whether it's for your site or for a site someone else wants you to help them set it up on Squarespace, because their platform takes care of everything. Hosting, you never even have to think about software updates or patches. Obviously, support, which is a huge thing. If you're setting a website up for somebody else and they need help with something, they ask Squarespace, not you. You want to get yourself out of that business, let Squarespace take care of it. And no matter what you're making, whether it's for you or somebody else, you will be surprised how fast it is to make everything with Squarespace. You just put things up there and it's just done. You can mess with the design if you want to, but you don't even have to. The stock stuff is beautiful. If you want to make little customizations, you can in like 2 seconds. Try it. Just try it. Next time you need to make anything, make your next move with Squarespace. See for yourself. When you're ready to check out, use offer code ATP to get 10% off your purchase of Squarespace. Make your next move at Squarespace.
So there was this crazy... there was this crazy rumor, or sort of rumor, that was posted on Slashdot as a comment. And this was in Slashdot parlance, an anonymous coward, which is to say somebody that didn't want to leave their name. But they went on and on about how there are several ARM-powered laptops that are drifting around internally at Apple, and this individual claims to have seen several with their own eyes. And they had a lot to say about it. I don't know the best way to summarize it, partially because I read this days ago and I haven't looked back since, which was in part because it seemed kind of bananas to me.
Right.
But but it seemed like the short version was, yeah, there's some apps that run on ARM and the OS is really iOS-ish, even though it isn't iOS. Like a lot of things that we like to control as you, even not even necessarily power users, but just users on Mac OS, not a lot of that is available on these supposed Phantom ARM Macs. I didn't think something about this didn't feel right to me. Like, I'm not sure I can point to a specific passage and say, yes, this is why it's bananas, but a lot of it just didn't feel right to me. And from what I gathered from people that I've spoken to, it didn't feel right to a lot of them, but we wanted to acknowledge its existence and we will put a link to the show notes. And I'm sure that the two of you have some thoughts on it as well.
I want to do more than just acknowledge it.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to entertain it as a possibility, because it's this is not a credible source, but let's just pretend, like, hypothetically, let's talk about this thing if it existed, right? Because I don't think the sourcing is enough to say that this does exist, but
I would say, in fact, the incredible shadiness of this post and so many of the like weird things that don't really sound very Apple-y or don't reflect how they actually work, I would say this is very unlikely to be true. But the reason I want to talk about this too, I was very happy to see it in the notes, is that this shows an interesting idea for where the Mac could plausibly go, because while the details of this are very suspicious that make you discount the validity of this report, I do think the overall idea of such a product is plausible, and the idea that Apple would take it in this direction is very plausible.
It's not just plausible. This is as soon as iOS appeared, this is basically the exact, not exemplar, but like this is the prototype of this rumor. The very second the first person said iOS Mac merge, like the very second someone said that many, many years ago, this is exactly what they were talking about. This is a Mac running on ARM CPUs, can only get apps from the App Store, everything locked down, all binary signed, can restore from the internet like a phone. Like, there is nothing in this that is even outside the realm of the things that have been talking. The only reason it is, you know, it's interesting, again, it's because it's being presented as truth. It's kind of the same way when you tell a joke, you pretend it's a real story that happened to you to make the joke funnier. That's exactly how this is working here. But because we haven't had, like, the reason it's worth talking about again is because we haven't revisited this idea of the iOS and Mac merge, totally lockdown Mac thing again. And in light of the actual appearance of ARM CPUs inside Macs with the Touch Bar Mac Pros, and in light of all the Intel stuff and so on and so forth, and our own revisiting of when is it going to be time to flip the Mac over to ARM, I think it's worth revisiting this old rumor of the merged, the merged iOS Mac. Not so much the merging of the OS's interface-wise, but of literally buttoning down the Mac in all the same ways that iOS is buttoned down. As an example of what we talked about last show, like, you know, either expanding the capabilities of iOS or making the Mac easier. This would be an example of taking all of those sharp edges in the Mac and filing them down as much as possible to make something that is hopefully almost as easy to use as an iPad, but still much more capable.
Yeah. And so I think it's worth going over some of the details because our chief summarizer in chief failed to.
Sorry. So
it's okay. You've had a long day. We'll get to that in the after show. But
true.
Yeah, sorry. But yeah, so basically the idea put forth by this comment basically is that it is it is like, you know, the next generation of laptop, presumably, or possibly of all Macs. It is an ARM processor, all custom Apple ARM hardware, just like the iPads and phones. It only boots the signed OS images that come over the internet. I assume not every time, not like a net boot, but like it only boots similar to iPhones and iPads. Like, there is no like physical install media. There's no like downgrading. It just, here's the software update for you. Here's what you get. You can't downgrade. You can't choose what version you run. Just here's what you get, period. They said, like, you know, a lot of the OS X legacy utilities and stuff are missing. There's no more X11. There's no audio MIDI setup. You know, a lot of that stuff. No disk utility, no terminal, which is interesting. System preferences and a lot of functionality has been moved into a new app called Settings to match iOS. The App Store is mandatory, including even things that require hardware drivers. It sounds kind of similar to when you plug in, like, or when you connect like a Bluetooth or Lightning device to a phone and it can associate itself with an app on the App Store that lets it work. Similar to that, but for drivers on the Mac. So you get a new, like, you know, scanner or something, you plug it in and it downloads it launches you to the Mac App Store to download the driver for that. Similarly, all drivers would be like, you know, kind of like iOS sandboxified, where something could install one of these drivers like at the deep level of system, but then you could just go into a system pref pane and like delete it and it's gone. It doesn't like leave files behind. You know, it's very iOS-y in that way of like, with iOS, you can delete an app and you know everything about that app is gone. Like there's no like remnants of it left in your phone or anything. And of course the Mac doesn't work that way now. You know, the Macs get gummed up over time with all this crap and you have like all this junk in your library folder and everything else. And so, and then a couple other things, but yeah, basically that's oh, and the file system is kind of like, how do you pronounce chroot in Linux world? Is it chroot? I don't know, but it's but basically the file system is like chrooted. So basically, like you like what appears to be at root is your home directory. And you don't even see the system files. They're not even there. Like they exist in the file system, but you don't see them from your point of view, from your user space. You see at root your files and nobody else's. And they said there was like no concept seemingly of multi-user stuff. But I don't want to get too much into the specifics of this post because again, I think the credibility of it is pretty low. But as a future direction of Mac OS and of the Mac hardware platform, I do think this is worth talking about, not only because it's so plausible based on what Apple seems to want to do, but also I think I will have the seemingly in this community very unpopular opinion that I think this could be really good with a few minor exceptions. I think this could be really good. The only things about this that give me a lot of pause are that it said that everything has to come through the Mac App Store. Like that's number one. And I think, you know, the Mac has this wonderful gatekeeper system. It has this kind of like code signing without app review system called Developer ID. If the Developer ID and gatekeeper come forward into whatever this is, again, assume this is real, even though it probably isn't. Thought experiment time. Okay. If this were to have some kind of like developer mode where you could build open source stuff, and, you know, however it's containered, if it's in your own little chrooted jail, fine. But if you can build open source stuff, if you can develop code, if you can, like, compile code with your C compiler or whatever else and just run it on this thing without the OS's code signing stuff interfering badly with that, if that's possible to do here, and, you know, and if you can distribute software through developer ID, which would bypass the Mac App Store, then I think this is not only plausible and could be good, but it might be great because a lot of this solves real problems with the Mac and with PC style OSs. One of the biggest problems is like how apps spread themselves out all over the place, all over the system. You know, they are like, it isn't, as I said, with iOS. You know, iOS, you delete the app, it's gone. On the Mac, you delete the app and there's garbage everywhere, and you have to use like Mac cleanup utilities to clean all the garbage out. Sometimes you have to go find these files that are spread all over your system, and you can't be sure what an app is doing when you install it and all this stuff. Like the PC and Mac style of app security is outdated. We've talked about this before, how the Unix idea of like anything you run just has access to your entire user account and everything you've ever written made on a user account and all your files, and it can delete files at will, it can read everything of yours. Like, that is an outdated model. That is not great for the future of computing. And one of the things that makes iOS so appealing to a lot of people for a lot of reasons is the additional simplicity and security that the sandboxing model that it has enforces. I think it is possible to do this well. A lot of Mac diehards are really against this idea when they saw this comment and assuming it might be real. And I can see why you would be so against this. But I think if, again, with just like that very slight tweak of like a developer mode, and being able to distribute software with developer ID, that's pretty much all I would need for this. It sounds like it would be really good in a lot of other ways. Either the Mac is in maintenance mode, as I keep saying, it seems that way, and nothing ever changes, and that's fine. Or if it is going to change, if Apple really is working on like the next generation of OS, not just 10 dot something else, the entire next generation, like when they went from Classic to OS X. If they are indeed working on such a thing for the Mac, which I would argue they should be, because it would be ridiculous to continue a computing platform forward with no plans to ever do that, then I think this is exactly the kind of thing they would do. And we should be prepared for it. And we can see a preview of what it's like by looking at iOS. Because iOS is even more restrictive than this. And so if this is plausible and if this happens and if it's done well with those couple of little holes punched through the wall for developers and for distribution through developer ID, as I said, I think this could be a great move forward. This could be the simplicity and security of iOS, but with windowing and file management and access to your files in a traditional paradigm and stuff like that. And yes, it would require a lot of apps to be rewritten. Some things that worked in the old system wouldn't work anymore. But a lot of this stuff is ancient. Like, I don't need X11 anymore. There's a lot of this stuff is so ancient. Mac OS is very old. It has accumulated cruft over time because everything does. This new way of doing things sounds like it could really be the actual future of computing that blends together the greatness of iOS with a PC-style paradigm to allow more types of work to get done for more people. This sounds really good to me.
The actual future of computing. I spend all this time explaining myself, and you just ignore me. It's fine. It's fine. Last week, we talked about how the iPad was making progress in terms of expanding its capabilities with multitasking and the pen and the bigger size and stuff, but kind of slowly. The Mac has been doing that same thing, but in the other direction, but even more slowly. Because if you think about the Mac trying to simplify itself, trying to be friendlier, this has been a process. The process took a pretty big leap with Classic to OS X, actually, because many things that were way more complicated in Classic were massively simplified. The dock is the best example of that. All the ways that you could manage the same stuff that the dock is supposed to do on Classic Mac OS at the time we transitioned, the dock was just like the most dumbed down version of all the other options that we had, not even including third party things, of which there were many. There's one first party thing. No, you can't use the private APIs to make your own dock type thing. We will fight you on that. And it is way simpler, and don't worry about it, because that's all everybody needs, right? And sandboxing, another example, a long, slow, painful slog, trying to get some of the benefits that you get in iOS, all your crap in one place, protect applications protected from each other, blah, blah, blah. It's been slow going. We haven't been able to get there because sandboxing is incompatible with lots of cool things that Mac apps have done and still want to do. And it's very difficult for Apple to ever get slowly, incrementally get it to the point where Mac applications are sandboxed in the same way as iOS applications. Instead, they've been saying, you can be a Mac app and your stuff can still be in seven different places because it kind of has to be, but we'll put some constraints on you. And it's this weird mismatch between having to do that, but also having to be protected from yourself and isolated from other applications. Even so far as like how many Mac apps have struggled with the sandbox because the integration point on PC style operating systems is very often the file system. And that's how applications share things with each other is I write a thing here and you open that same thing over there. And the user's allowed to make little folders and put stuff in them. And you're trying to sandbox things. So each application only sees its own files, but like it's been difficult. And so this description of the iOSified Mac, which again has been in people's minds and talked about for many, many years now. The question is always, how do you get from where we are to there? Because it's a big leap, and trying to do it incrementally has been very difficult. It's been taking a long time. It hasn't been particularly successful. A lot of efforts have stalled out despite a lot of effort put into it. It gets back to the question from the last week's show. Is it easier to make the iPad more capable or make the Mac friendlier and simpler? And unquestionably, I think it's still easier to make iOS more capable, because if you try to make the Mac simpler, everything about the system and the users and the developers fights you at every step, because there's so much entrenched tradition and software and conventions and capabilities and attitudes and just like, and cruft, like Marco said, just plain old cruft, that it's difficult to get there. So this the post here is almost kind of like wishful thinking. Like, wouldn't it be great if we could snap our fingers and be there? And like Marco said, one way you can do that is say, okay, well, it's not macOS anymore. It's a new OS called something else. You know, like people would have said macOS 11 back in the days before the 10 got dropped, right? But this really, it would be a leap of that size if it appeared wholesale. You can still get there piecemeal. It's going to take a long time. You might have to wait for some people to die. And there are many places where this can go terribly wrong. For example, like it's obvious to us on this program as rabid Mac users that of course you'd have to have some mode that most people wouldn't use, but that would give you access to the terminal, that would let you build software, because you know, we're software developers and we know any software developer who uses a Mac, no matter what kind of development you're doing, even if you're doing everything in Xcode, I would imagine, but it's definitely if you're doing development, for any kind of server side software, you're used to being able to install and run software like that is not signed with Apple's developer ID thing. All that Unix open source stuff, that's not signed with developer ID. And if you literally can't run binaries that are not signed, if you don't have that final option in Gatekeeper to launch applications with, you know, the right click in the open and all that, you know, or just launching it from the command line, like if that option like literally does not exist, as it doesn't on iOS unless you jailbreak, and I really don't want to be jailbreaking my Mac, that eliminates just so many users. This is not even an edge case anymore. This is like a large percentage of people who, you know, whole professions who use Macs at their desks need the ability to do that type of stuff and are going to need it for the foreseeable future. So if you cut them off, then you're just marginalizing the Mac too much, I think, because they would be eaten up by iOS on one side and you abandon everybody else who's using those features on the Mac. And so that's a danger zone as well. But the general idea of like, let me just close my eyes and open them again, and the Mac, at the very least, solves one or two or three of the biggest problems. It still wouldn't be solving the file system problem, even with the chroot stuff and everything. But at least you'd solve app install, management, drivers. Regular users wouldn't have to see disk images anymore. Settings and preferences would be more coherent and familiar because they're used to iOS. Like, just those wins would be huge. And if you can get those wins while also allowing people to do their work in the old way if they want to, like, that's, talk about progressive disclosure, like, no one, if it's a developer mode or whatever, like, no one, believe me, people aren't going to be like, I want to have developer mode turned on. No, nobody wants that. They want it to be simple and nice. It's like Casey's grandparents, they're overjoyed when it's like, oh, this is simple, I just do this and it all makes sense to me, there's no place I can get into trouble. They're not going to go looking for the thing to turn on developer mode. That's for power users, quote unquote. And yes, there is a class of person who will go looking for it and turn it on, and you know, because they're interested in that. They're, you know, they're geeks, they're nerds, that's fine. But regular people, trust me, do not want the complexity. Like, all of us, when we go into a preferences screen and we see an advanced button, we click it immediately. Other people don't even want to go to the preference screen. Like, they don't even want to know the preference screen exists. They probably don't know the preference screen exists. Like, it doesn't need to exist. They just want it to work and work fine. So I'm pretty much with Marco that I would love a Mac that worked like this, as long as I had the option to you know, the developer mode or the way to do all that stuff. I'm not sure how long it will take to get there, whether Apple has the will and wants to dedicate the resources to get there, because it just seems like still a much more straightforward path to continue to enhance iOS. I feel like iOS is getting, at this rate, iOS is still getting more sophisticated at a faster rate than the Mac is getting simpler, which is fine with me as an old Mac user. But if I start drawing lines on graphs and seeing how this ends up, it just seems to me that unless Apple has a massively renewed interest in the Mac, that iOS will eventually overtake it, because for whatever their interest is in the Mac, their interest in iOS seems much stronger on the phone and still even a little bit stronger on the iPad. And who knows what other weird devices they're planning. I mean, you got the Watch thrown in the mix there too. Like, iOS as a legacy-free basis for innovation seems like a much easier path than continuing to bang their head against the Mac.
You know, the by and large, I agree with you guys, but I can't help but think a couple things. One, it almost sounds like you're saying, I want the good parts of iOS and none of the parts that bother me. And that's okay. Like, I mean, yeah, that does sound good in and of itself. But I mean, for two people that really don't seem to be too terribly interested in the iPad, it's interesting hearing you say, oh, I'd love all that stuff on the iPad.
Whose people are those? I use the iPad every day.
So do I.
I use the iPad more than I use my Mac.
Well, I can't say that, but I do use the iPad at home.
At home, I use, definitely. Obviously, I work all day on a Mac, so that's the majority of my time. But in my house, I use my iPad literally every day, and many days go by when I don't wake my Mac from sleep.
Well, but I think to clarify this, it's not that all of iOS is bad. There's tons of great stuff in iOS. There's tons of advantages of iOS. There's a between the way iPads work and the way macOS works, there's a huge difference in interaction paradigm, the file, you know, the whole difference between being, you know, macOS is very file centric, like most PCOSs, whereas, you know, iOS is app centric. Like, these are massive differences in just the way these systems work. Of course, you can take some of what's good about one and apply it to the other. The only question is, you know, where's your starting point and where are you going? And, you know, like, as you know, as John said, it's a lot easier to make iOS more capable than to make macOS simpler. However, no matter what you do to iOS, it's still going to feel like a big phone that's app-centric and not file-centric and everything else, because that's just like the entire design of the system. Whereas on the Mac, if what you want is the PC style of computing, it is totally possible with something like this crazy scheme, that this crazy comment that is probably BS, it is totally possible to take the best of PC-style computing, make it still work the way that people who want that are accustomed to, but bring in the modern advantages of iOS.
Yeah, that summary makes a lot more sense to me.
Imagine if you gave your grandparents this Mac described in here. I think, with the possible exception of the keyboard being intimidating, they could be just as delighted, because from their perspective, if it's simple and they can figure out how to use it, like if it was basically as simple as the only way you could launch applications is with Launchpad. Launchpad was always visible in a thing. It would probably have to be touch, which is another issue entirely in terms of bridging that divide. But like, if they were never faced with the complexity of an open save dialog box, or never had to look at a bunch of files or little documents on the desktop, or never even looked at the desktop, and it was just basically had the simplicity of an iPad but happened to be a Mac, they would be just as delighted, because they just want to accomplish a task. The task is video, you know, a video conference with my family and be able to send emails or whatever. And you and I could say, oh, if you had a MacBook Adorable, you could do it just fine. But the difference between a MacBook Adorable and an iPad to them is huge. So all you need to do to delight them with a Mac is make it so that when they use it, it is just as simple as an iPad. It can still have lurking under the covers all the other complexity. The file system stuff is a place where we continue to punt and Apple continues to punt. I hold out hope that there is still a better way to collaborate on things than the completely app-centric island model of iOS and the completely file-centric world of the PC. But considering no one has figured it out yet, you know, we'll just leave that off to the future. But again, we are talking about the future of computing, not the present. But anyway, like that's why I think this Mac is this type of Mac is appealing, because it will start to blur the lines that we're all thinking in terms of. Because once something like this appears on the scene, we can't have the same conversation anymore. It's a different conversation entirely.
Yeah, the thing that that I'm curious to see if this becomes real one day, and if the three of us are still blathering on the show, is what are the restrictions and how egregious are they? And I mean, Marco talked about this some, but like if there's a developer mode, what does that really give you? And do you have file system access just to your change rooted root area? Can you get all the way to the root? Can I install a kernel extension? Would I want to? I can't help but feel like, let's say this dropped on our laps tomorrow and, you know, Marco or you or me or all three of us buy one. I think inevitably what would happen is it would put roadblocks in our way in ways we find frustrating. And what I'm not sure about is, would your average developer, when looking to his or her left and seeing the Touch Bar MacBook Pro, and then looking to his or her right and seeing this Phantom ARM-based Mac, I mean, certainly I would choose the Touch Bar MacBook Pro because it doesn't limit me at all. And this hypothetical new Mac, while it does fix a lot of problems for people in general, I don't think it solves any problem that I'm seeing today. And so I can just see, I have visions of this being like a less extreme version of me saying, well, I don't like working on the iPad because I feel like it constrains me and I feel like the Mac is freeing, because that is how I feel. And I think that this hypothetical new ARM Mac would be a lot of the same in that regard, if perhaps a little bit less of it.
A lot of what we would want as developers could be accomplished through VMs.
True.
You know, like if it was still possible to have virtual machines running on this in some form, a lot of this could be solved by containering and by virtual machines. Of like, you know, right now, like, oh geez, I lost a day this week on Monday. I spent a whole day finally fixing my local Apache and PHP MySQL installations between my iMac and my laptop, both of which, my laptop never had a working one because I did a clean install when I got it, and I just never finished setting it up and fixing Homebrew and fixing PHP and fixing the built-in Apache to use the right version of PHP and all this crap. And I tried MAMP, and then I didn't like it, so I stopped trying MAMP, and like fiddling with all this stuff that's like all over the file system, all the stuff that Homebrew puts and different other package managers do it, and then Homebrew complains that other package managers exist, and it's like dealing with all this crap all over the file system that gets upgraded when the system gets upgraded, that I'm trying to put my own stuff into and edit the config files and everything else. Like, I, during a lot of that, I'm like, you know, why don't I just install VirtualBox and just make a Linux VM and just run all the stuff in there and be fine.
Try Docker. You've got a modern enough Mac that you can run Docker.
I know I should know about Docker. I know nothing about Docker. I know the general high level concept of what it is. I've never seen it, never used it. No idea how it works. But anyway,
you should try it before you go the full VM route. And in the meantime, you should compile everything from source and install in user local like I do.
Oh, well, and I did actually. You know, I eventually moved to the full Homebrew setup. Took me a while to realize that Homebrew installs its own version of Apache, but but it did finally do that. But it was so much messing around and so much crap, and I know that future OS updates will probably break it.
Never touch the system files. You can only mess in user local. Do not touch anything else. Pretend it doesn't exist.
Yeah, well, and I did eventually move to that system. But my point is, that is not that different from what if on this hypothetical, you know, next generation Mac OS lockdown mode, which would be the only mode. what if in this OS developer mode existed? Which I think, again, I do think that developer mode needs to exist, where you can just compile stuff or you can run open source software that is compiled from source or through package managers or whatever else. Somehow you can run open source stuff. You can build it yourself and just run it. And somehow there needs to be a way to, you know, to distribute software out of the App Store with developer ID, gatekeeper, whatever. That's so, given those two exceptions, suppose developer mode is rooted in such a way that, you know, you basically get your own version of user local in this little virtualized environment within your home directory. That's not that different from what we have now. And that's totally fine. We could totally work with that. It would be fine. As long as there's still a way to have a terminal and a way to compile software you get from other places, all of these workflows don't break. Just the file paths might change slightly. That's it.
Yeah, it could be done well, like, so that you don't feel constrained, Casey. Like, so you don't feel like you're suddenly trapped, because it would just be a matter of coming onto the machine and flipping a few switches and be like, ah, back to normal. But really, the ultimate cure for this is the same thing that solved the exact same situation in the change from classic Mac OS to OS X, which was a big, you know, increase in simplicity and downgrade in customizability, with the elimination of whole categories of interfaces and ways of working, and lots of third-party things being replaced by first-party things that could not be enhanced or replaced in a supported manner. The solution is, guess what? There is no more classic macOS. So, nah. Like, that was the solution. It's like, well, you know, go use Windows or Linux, or this is the future of the Mac. Like, I don't envision the Mac described in this comment here existing alongside the other Macs for any appreciable amount of time. There would be a transition, and you're either on board or you're not.
Yeah,
and, that's exactly how it would have to work, and especially if they go there by increments. But again, if you could blink and open your eyes and this thing was here, they wouldn't keep them both around. The other thing would go away. So that would basically solve the problem for you. And hopefully, like I said, you wouldn't feel constrained.
Well, maybe Tim Cook would keep selling the old thing for 10 more years after that.
Yeah. Well, you know, the software, they're a little bit better about that. They do upgrade it. But like, that you wouldn't, in the same way, initially, a lot of classic Mac users felt constrained in OS X because it was very young and slow and was missing a lot of things and was simpler. And in some respects, I still feel constrained by some of the interface things in OS X. But you get used to it, and eventually it becomes the new normal, and you accept that it comes with many other benefits. So I would imagine that this type of Mac would be palatable to you, if not immediately, then in short order. As long as they didn't screw it up. Because I feel like one of the ways that Apple, especially today's Apple, could massively screw this up is by going too far and cutting off all those other avenues. Because if the Mac can't support that type of user, like, why bother having the Mac? Now, I'm saying that's the only reason for the Mac's existence, but it's like, then what are you even doing? You're squeezing the Mac from both sides until it's basically like a really weird iOS. Because presumably iOS would still be advancing. So it's like this really weird iOS version that can't do the things that a Mac used to do, but isn't as simple as iOS. And they put all these resources into morphing the Mac into this thing. And it's like, what's the point? At that point, you have to concede that Microsoft had the right approach and that you've just been wasting your time with this dual OS strategy as you shave one of your OSs from both sides until all that's left is this little skinny spindle that just topples over.
Well, and if they did this, again, like, you know, I said earlier, like, the, you know, this, we haven't had a major OS transition in a while from Apple, not since, you know, 99 or whenever it was. John, I'm sure, has some idea of when that was. But
2001 was 10.1?
There you
10.0?
Go.
Yeah. That's my guess.
Yeah, so, you know, we haven't had a transition since then. In the Windows world, they have them a little more often, but it still doesn't come that often. And when you have a major OS transition like that, one of the luxuries of this, it's painful, no question. It's painful. It's time consuming for a while. There's a transition period that just sucks for everybody. However, it is an opportunity to modernize app frameworks, to add new capabilities, to do things, to basically take the opportunity that you have, that you're kind of forcing app makers to do something new, to do like a major update or to even do a rewrite, to take the opportunity to make it better for everybody. So for instance, some of the things they could do with the Mac if they did this, and if they presumably broke a lot of old apps, they could finally make like a more unified UI framework, for one. Like, make UIKit for the Mac, and I don't mean make everything look like navigation controllers and make it all function the same way in the UI, but, you know, there's like some of the simple low-hanging fruit, like unify the way like table views load their data, and make it so we don't have NS color and UI color anymore, and stuff like that. Like, there's a lot of stuff they could do to unify those two frameworks. They could do things like, as I mentioned previously, cellular Macs, because they could implement better control over networking and do all this stuff. Like, it would give them the opportunity to, it would force us to live for a while with incompatible software with, oh, well, we can't do this on the new OS yet because this app hasn't been updated or whatever. We have to drag along Microsoft and Adobe or whatever else. But then when we got there, it could be so much better because app makers have been forced to update. Right now, the Mac software ecosystem is, you know, there are some bright spots, but a lot of it's just a graveyard because most people who make Mac apps, it's a low priority for them because they can keep making the same old app over and over again, and it's fine, and they can focus their efforts on iOS and stuff. If the Mac changes, yes, some of them will get lost, but the ones that want to stay on the Mac will have to put effort into it, and that will make their apps better, and that will make it better for all of us. So, like, there would be a substantial silver lining, not to mention all the benefits of the OS itself, as I said, of things like the better security, the better sandboxing of the apps, like not having their crap go all over the system. This could be really good on a number of ways if something like this were to happen. It would definitely be painful. And some stuff that you could do now on macOS, you'd never be able to do on this. But look at, tying it back together, look at how many people do everything they need to do on phones and iPads. This can do more than that. Everyone who says like they can't do stuff on iOS, sometimes it's because of a capability that iOS just will never be able to do because of its security model. But sometimes it's just because it doesn't have a very good multitasking model or a very good file system model or very, you know, things that that this would actually have. So I think it would be a painful transition to go to something like this, but it wouldn't be impossible. We would all grumble, we'd all complain, but then we'd get on board. A few things wouldn't be possible anymore forever, and we'd deal with it. We'd find new solutions. Like, if I couldn't use Audio Hijack anymore to record this phone call from Skype, then we'd probably either stop using Skype, or we would, you know, we could switch to one of those like web-based podcast recorder things. There's already like five of those, and there's only going to be more by the time this thing ever exists. So there's always workarounds. There's always things like time would solve any pain that would be there. So I think, even though this is probably all wrong and based on this one weird post on Slashdot that's probably BS, this kind of sounds cool. And if it happened, assuming it had those two exceptions of developer mode and developer ID distribution, I think that'd be really nice.
You have to throw cold water on this. We have to bring back to our old refrain. Anytime we discuss anything radical happening to the Mac is like, yeah, but that would cost a lot of money and take a lot of time and resources. And does Apple want to put that much money into its legacy platform, or however you want to describe the Mac, because sales volume-wise, you can justify almost any investment in iOS. Can you justify that same? And the iPad is along for the ride, because even though the iPad's volume is similar to the Mac, guess what? It's got the same OS as the phone, so congratulations. You get a lot of development stuff, quote-unquote, for free. But this would be a hell of an investment in the Mac. It would be on the scale of the classic to OS X transition, or at least close. Maybe not that big, but it would be close. And it would be the biggest investment in the Mac software-wise in many, many, many years. And so I think it could, you know, I'm not saying it couldn't be. The right people pitch it, it could be sold within the company, but it would be a departure from the historic investment in the Mac, which has been good. And it's, you know, it hasn't been as high since the transition from OSs as, you know, as is appropriate, or even the transition for CPU architecture. But this would be an architecture transition and an OS transition that is the second biggest one that Apple has ever done. And, you know, we're all on board for it and would be ready for it, but I'm not entirely sure that Apple is ready to put that money into the Mac, which, not that that is the most dubious thing about this random Slashdot comment, but again, like, I wouldn't characterize it as novel or interesting. I would characterize it as a reiteration of the prototypical idea of a Mac merged with iOS resurfacing now in a new context. And the new context is the new Apple and the new state of Intel versus ARM and the new sales figures for iPad and all of us new people being older and wiser and having seen more of the tech world reconsidering the same thing.
Well, in that case, I will put it in terms they will understand. You can sell iPad hardware for $1,500.
They already do. That's not including all the cases.
Wow. And that's our end.
Thanks to our three sponsors this week, Betterment, Squarespace, and SetApp. And we will see you next week.
So iPad hardware for MacBook Pro prices, $2,600.
There you go.
Now the show is over. They didn't even mean to begin, because it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. John didn't do any research. Marco and Kevin. FCC wouldn't let him, cause it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. And you can find the show notes at atp.fm. And if you're into Twitter, you can follow them at CASEYLISS. So that's Casey Liss, MARCOARMENT, Marco Arment, SIRACUSA, Syracuse. It's accidental.
So, Casey, I hear you're having some car trouble.
Yes, indeed. So I brought my car in to get the oil changed. I don't care that you think that's preposterous. Don't care. I don't have the time to change my oil.
Why is that preposterous? Because are you talking to us or the audience who's scolding you?
No, the audience. I'm hopefully preventing all
the
people.
No one in the audience is scolding you about not changing your own oil.
Oh, okay. You can send a tweet to at Syracusa about how angry you are that I'm not changing my own oil.
Even people who change their own oil, I feel like, now realize that they are outliers.
Probably. So I had a coupon. I was very excited. I had a coupon. So my BMW oil change was supposed to be $90, which I understand is expensive.
Wait, you were getting into the dealership? Now it's time for me to scold you.
Yeah. I was going to the dealership.
Now you're going to hear from them.
Yep. So, okay. I understand I am not innocent, and I have made mistakes. Mistakes have been made. However,
hey, I do the same thing.
Well, you don't get your oil changed anymore. But anyway.
What I did.
If you're going to the dealership anyway... Okay, but if you're going to the dealership to get your oil changed, no, don't do that.
Well, I don't trust like a Jiffy Lube or anything like that. And
oh, geez. I get it. You don't have a Ferrari. We have to go to this special little Italian person.
It requires synthetic, and it doesn't matter. The point is...
By the way, for the record, I think it might be covered when you have a lease. I'm not sure, but just for the record there.
If it's free, then yes, by all means.
I believe they are, and it was free for me when I first owned the car, because I still had some of the maintenance program.
Yeah, it was like 5 years, right?
I forget. It was 4, I think. It doesn't really matter. But anyway, so I had my $90 coupon. I'm all excited with myself. I had the wherewithal to ask for a loaner, which I was very glad for, and we'll see why in a moment. But here's my $90 coupon. I should expect to see you later today. I probably didn't even need to bother getting a loaner. I'm going to drive it the handful of miles to work, and then probably immediately later, a handful of miles back, and that'll be that. I get a call as I'm out to lunch, and they say, in so many words, oh, things relating to the drivetrain in the front. I have an all-wheel drive BMW, before you get all angry. Things relating to the drivetrain in the front, like tie rods and bushings and things of that nature. And the adjustment screw that you use in order to do an alignment has seized. Things are breaking. That'll be $1,000, please. Oh, and you'll get your car back tomorrow because we don't have all the parts. Fine. So in and of itself, okay, fine. The car has almost 70,000 miles on it, if I remember correctly. It is not unreasonable that things would be going wrong. But in the last year and change, I had a $5,000 or $6,000 repair of the Vano system. I had a $1,000 water pump issue that was almost last month. It was just barely in December. And now I have this $1,000 issue. And I think this is the universe giving me a sign that this car is not long for this world. So I'm getting some pressure from Aaron, and I think it's completely justified to unload the thing because it's just, I can't keep the damn thing on the road. And at first I was resisting, but now I'm to the point that I'm like, screw it. This thing is not worth my time anymore. I want to get rid of it. Now, on paper, the right answer is get a brand new 3 Series, maybe an M3 if I want to spend too much money. Maintenance will be covered, at least in the beginning. It'll have a nice big fat warranty. Problem solved. Except I feel like I've been burned by BMW. I think new ones are, as I think we talked about recently, new ones are just unaffordable. So, and then that becomes, okay, well, fine, get a pre-owned one. Well, I just did that. And yes, this one, this hypothetical new pre-owned one would be with the CPO warranty, which goes to like 100,000 miles. And yes, that's possible. But even if I'm not paying out of pocket constantly for my car to be in the shop, my car's still in the damn shop all the time. And I feel like the moment a BMW gets past like lease time, things start falling apart. And I have friends have had similar experiences. I just don't want to be bothered by it. So I have many options in front of me. If you recall, my requirements, which are somewhat loose, are I don't want front-wheel drive. I want it to get to 60 in under 6 seconds. I don't care that that's not necessary on regular roads. That's what I want. I want three pedals, and that's mostly it. So what are my options? I'm only thinking about new right now, and then I'm going to start trying to rack my brain for used because I'm not opposed to going used. But looking at it, I think every single one of my options has problems. A friend of mine actually just written in Cadillac ATS. Great call, but the infotainment is, from everything I've ever understood, unusable, just utterly unusable. And I don't know if it has CarPlay. I'd have to check that out. So that is a potential. If
it's,
I'm willing
also
to
have, hideous.
Yeah, it's too ugly to be fairly, too ugly to be seen in. Sorry. Great car. Too ugly.
Fairly hideous. I'm not arguing. Fairly hideous. Okay, so let's just... it sounds like the brain trust has eliminated that. So if I'm willing to have wrong wheel drive, Focus ST. The problem with that, other than it being a Ford, which in and of itself is fine, but it's front wheel drive, which I don't particularly care for. And then the RS is also, is it the RS? Whatever the super hot roddy one is. That one is just too 18-year-old for me. I'm turning 35 next month. Just no way. The ST is a reasonable compromise, but wrong wheel drive. If I'm willing to go back to Deutschland, I have the Volkswagen GTI, the Golf R, which is the thing that I think I'm most interested in, the A4 and the S3, which is basically a Golf R, but in sedan form, if I'm not mistaken.
What? Come on.
What? What
you
are you
listed a
over?
Series of little Euro hatchbacks, and then you lump the A4 and the S3 in them, like, oh, it's the same thing.
No, the A4 is wildly different. The S3, I thought, was basically the drivetrain of the Golf R. I am on day...
Oh, no, yeah, under the cover, sure, but it's a whole, like, from the outside. It's the difference between driving around in a rabbit and driving around in a regular car.
You're dating yourself even calling it a rabbit.
Here's the thing. I could rule out all four of these right now for you. Because
A4 is a good car. It's a little boring, but I think Casey should try it before he decides it's too boring. Because it's nice looking. If it has the features he wants, it's reasonably nice inside and out. The main slam against it is that it's more boring than the BMWs. But I think he should test drive it.
Is the A4 even available in stick?
Yes.
Oh, it is? Okay. I thought it wasn't. Yes. Anyway.
Oh, no, it is.
All right. So the A4 is basically a 3 Series that's slightly worse. Like...
it depends on what you want. If you want it smoother, kind of nicer, even keel experience.
Okay. If you want a crappier interior and higher prices,
I would disagree with you there.
They look nice. They don't feel nice.
I'm not so sure I agree with you there.
Also, iDrive is way better than their weirdo system.
iDrive is light years better than MMI, at least as of about a year ago. Now, I think there might be a new MMI.
Has the updated one, or if it's still in the old one.
I don't know either. I thought it had the new hotness one, which I have yet to try. But the A4 supports CarPlay. I don't think it's wireless CarPlay, but it's CarPlay. S3 is basically a Golf R, although a buddy of mine is saying it might be DSG only, which might eliminate it from contention. Then the Golf R, obviously. All of these are appealing because they are not front-wheel drive, but that's going back to Germany, and I can't tell if this is a German car problem or if it's a BMW problem.
It's an expensive car problem, because every car around 60,000 miles, especially if you live in the Northeast, which you don't really, but if you did, like around 60 or 70,000, crap starts falling apart and breaking or whatever. The problem is that when crap falls apart and breaks on a BMW, it costs $1 billion to fix. So that's where your problem is. Like any car you keep for that number of miles, you're going to have, like, if you have a car for 100,000 miles and you have to replace the water pump, it's not a surprise. Like, it's a thing that happens, right?
That's fair.
But if the water pump costs you $1,500, then you're driving a BMW.
Right. That's the thing, is that in and of itself, any one of these repairs, fine, whatever. Well, maybe not the Vanos exploding, but generally speaking, like...
the engine stuff, I feel like if you had a Honda, it would still be fine. You would not need to put that much money into the engine.
Yeah, the entire body would rust off the car before the engine would need any work on a Honda.
So I could go back to Germany, Golf R, A4, S3 apparently is definitely DSG only. from what I'm being told. So that's eliminated from contention.
It's also really overpriced for what you're buying.
That's probably true. I forgot to mention the GTI. I think I mentioned the GTI. I've heard the performance pack is phenomenal, the GTI performance pack. However, that is also wrong wheel drive. So far, still in contention, Focus ST, wrong wheel drive. GTI performance pack, wrong wheel drive. R, German. A4, German, a little bit boring. And then now I get into like the real slim pickings. If I'm willing to go extremely slowly, I could get an Accord, which I cannot option the way I want, or a Mazda 6, which I cannot option the way I want. And then if I'm willing to live inside of my car because I will be divorced and never get to see my wife or child again, I could get a Tesla.
So here's one of the big questions here is, do you want this to be a car that can comfortably hold your kid?
Sitting here now, yes. That's probably ruining everything, but yeah, we're going to go with yes on this one.
Because then the only options on this list that can go fast are the Model S. That's it. Like,
no, that's not true. The A4
is on, goes plenty fast.
Yeah, it's about the same speed as my car. It's a little slower, but not too much slower.
Don't do the A4. If you're going to get against
the A4. I think you need to go to a dealer, and Casey needs to go to a dealer and look at the A4. Now, you're not buying, just going there to look at it. Maybe take a test drive, poke around. You're not even thinking of buying. Just check it out. Because I feel like Marco's anti-Audi bias is unwarranted.
Audi is great, but BMW is better. It's simple as that. Like, Audi makes great cars.
Not the current ones. Not the current 3 Series with the weirdo electric steering and the ugly outsides and the bazillion dollars worth of options.
Well, but I mean, talk about bazillion dollars worth of options. Audi is also the same way about the option pricing and the repair costs and everything else. Like that. Yeah. Basically, in most of the downsides, they're the same or roughly the same. And I think BMW's upsides are better. Basically, I think Audis are, again, they're nice cars. Some of them are really nice cars, but the interior I've always thought felt noticeably cheaper than BMW's. The media
disagree.
System is a major step backwards.
I deeply agree.
Yeah, and they I'm actually kind of surprised that they still offer a stick, because I think most of their cars they don't even offer that as an option anymore. Although to be fair, BMW is not that different in that regard. So basically,
you can get an A4 Premium Plus with all wheel drive. And actually, the only available transmission is the 6-speed.
It does have CarPlay, by the way. I was just flipping through their website. They got a big screenshot of it.
So there you go. It's not wireless, but it is CarPlay, nevertheless.
Wait, hold on. The A4, which one? The Premium Plus?
Just a plain old A4. I'm just swapping through the things.
With a big screenshot front-wheel drive or all-wheel drive?
No, all-wheel drive.
Oh, okay. They have that in a stick?
Yeah.
Oh,
that's what
that.
I'm saying.
Six-speed
it's basically
manual.
My car. I mean, it's a four-cylinder turbo, but otherwise, it's basically my car. It's 6-speed, all-wheel drive, etc.
I wasn't aware that they were still making all-wheel drive with stick. That's pretty
well,
good.
Well, and I think this is new. I think they just added the manual transmission option like this model year, even though I think the refresh happened months and months ago, maybe even
last
model year.
That's the thing about the time to get rid of your car. It's not so much whether your car is falling apart, is that the longer you wait, the less chance you have to get any car with a stick.
That's
period.
Very true. But I mean, you know, you would have some warning when that was going to happen. But anyway, that is in broad strokes, that is true. So I would say for you, I'm telling you as a friend, Casey.
I'm not buying a damn Tesla.
This
Marco.
Is this,
it's
no, no. I'm telling you as a friend. This is my intervention here.
Mm-hmm.
I would rather you buy an overpriced German hatchback than
not a hatchback.
Listen,
no.
I would rather you buy an overpriced German hatchback than to have you compromise on what's really important to you and to have you get an Accord or a Mazda.
Well, that's the thing. It's like the Accord is a nice car.
But what about versus the A4? Why'd you just eliminate that one? I can understand what you're saying. Like, I'd rather have you get a sporty hatchback than a boring sedan. Fine, right? Well, I'd rather have you get a sporty hatchback than a sporty sedan like the A4? No.
The A4 is fine. You know, you've driven one before, Casey. You know what they are.
Yes, but I haven't driven one of the new ones. The last one I drove was the pre-refresh version, and my understanding is a lot changed with this refresh for the better.
Then it's definitely worth seeing, because as we know, BMW has had some shortcomings with the new 3 Series.
I completely agree with you guys. A4. Absolutely, absolutely worth a look. I think the Golf R would probably be a more exciting car. And certainly, I'm pretty sure it'd be considerably quicker. But the A4, I think, would be sufficient in every metric that I can think to throw at it.
also expensive to repair and maintain, by the way.
Well,
so
and that's
you're still shopping
right.
in German luxury sedans, and so. But you, but if you got, especially if you got it new, so
here's,
you'd have a
here's
good,
the question: would you consider either new financing or leasing, which would then take care of the maintenance issue for the most part, if not entirely?
Yeah, see, I mean, financing, whatever, that's, it. You know, whatever. But
lease it, do it, just lease it.
Well, but I don't want to lease a car. Like, I don't.
Then when the lease is up, you can get a Model 3 if you're lucky.
Well, that's true. So the thing with leasing is that in a perfect world, what I want is the situation we have with Aaron's car. Aaron's car has been in the shop for repairs fewer times in the 10 years we've owned it, well, 9.5 at this point, than my car has in the last 10 months.
And what is it? A boring, reliable Japanese car.
It's a boring, reliable Japanese car.
It's boring, slow, and reliable. You don't want that. That would crush your soul.
But I want something. But it will crush my soul. But I want something that'll last more than 10 freaking minutes.
You have it. It's called Aaron's car.
It's called all my Honda Accords.
Yes. No, yeah, look, if you want to have a boring, reliable car, there's lots of great options. Pretty much everything from Honda, Toyota, there's lots of good options.
Hondas aren't boring. Toyota's boring. Honda is as exciting as it can be given the horsepower. All right, I'm not saying this is got a powerful engine in it, but it is.
Okay. But
it's a thinking man's BMW, Rave's car and driver.
Okay, but anyway.
Just test drive one of those anyway. You won't be able to find a stick to test drive, but you should, well, I don't know. Maybe next time you visit, you can test drive mine and see what it's like.
I mean, the thought has crossed my mind that maybe it is worth testing it because, oh my God, it's bananas I understand that what I'm about to say is a bit preposterous, but all I want is a 6-speed, not front wheel drive car with 4 doors that gets to 60 in less than 6 seconds that will last for more than 60,000 miles. Is that so much to ask?
How fast is this A4?
I think 5.5-ish, something like that. It's actually much quicker than one would think.
I mean, you can go to the S4 if you want more out of it.
It's a lot more money though, right?
I certainly wouldn't be doing that new, for sure.
So here's the thing. Look, I mean, this is one of those, like, you know, project management triangle situations. Like,
It is.
For what you want, there's basically, you have to either pick, like, fast but crappy, or, like, you know, slow but nice, or used and expensive to maintain. It's like you have to pick one of these things, or you raise the budget and you get divorced. I mean, one of these things has to budge, or you have to be willing to tolerate something that you don't want to tolerate right now. So whether that is the shame of driving an Audi, or
it's
whether
not
it is
shameful,
whether it's spending more than you wanted to spend, or whether it's having more high price maintenance down the road, or giving up your entire soul and driving an Accord. And I say this as somebody who bought an Accord at one time and enjoyed it for a couple of years.
Opportunity cost. Think about how much, what you could buy with the money you save buying the Accord and how much happier that would make you.
Is there anything that would make Casey happier than a fast car, John? Come on.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, like, I understand what you're driving at, but
this is Casey we're talking about.
How about college education for your children? Just saying.
This is not going to make or break Declan's college education for Dodge 6.
Right, so therefore, I think basically you have a tough decision to make. John will push you towards the Accord.
I'm pushing him towards the Audi. I'm just saying the Accord isn't as bad as you make it out to be. But he wants something faster, so the Accord isn't it. So try the Audi.
Oh yeah, I mean basically since none of the three of us have driven the current generation, apparently the newest A4. I guess I've come around. I think you should try that. Because I do find the F generation of BMWs, the F30 generation of BMWs, to be pretty underwhelming in a lot of ways. And as you mentioned, quite expensive for what you get. That being said, so is the Audi. However, I think it's certainly worth trying.
Well, but let's go build one. We can keep talking, but let's build an Audi. I started down that path and I got sidetracked.
It looks like there is currently no S4. Is it like between update generations? Because I just did the A4.
I think that's correct. What color would I get? Let me turn off flux and blind myself.
I don't know what color you would get.
Shut up.
That would be a
God,
very
you're such a jerk.
I don't know how to even consider picking a color for you.
You got to get with the program. It's the year of the red car. So that's what you got to do, right?
Oh, is it okay? We can go red.
Marco got a red car. I got a red car. Come on.
I'm not sure how this looks in red. It looks okay, but I wonder. Let's see what else. Audi historically makes a very good premium black.
That is a nice black, actually. Oh, yeah. I can't do a black car. Stop. I can't do a black car.
I mean, look, they have like four different shades of white. Literally, they have, let's see, there's glacier white metallic. There's floret silver, which is so light it's basically matte, is basically white. There's cuvee silver, which is kind of champagne, but almost white. There's ibis white, which is another white. And there's monsoon gray, which is a pretty light gray, almost white. So this actually is your brand. Maybe all these years talking about BMWs that we've been wrong all this time, and you actually wanted a brand that has five different shades of white on every new car to choose from.
The 19-inch wheels, because I'm an idiot.
No. You gotta pick the Sport Plus package. Go with 18, because the 19s don't look that much better than 18s, and the ride will be better in 18s.
You're such an old man.
No, I'm just serious.
It's right.
With 1-inch difference, you're not going to be able to eyeball it. It's not like you'll just have to deal with the fact that your wheels are smaller than mine, but it'll be fine.
Oh, listen to this guy.
But see, and here's the thing, though. Like, performance-wise, you're roughly in, like, the 328 category of performance here. But you're spending like $45,000 at least.
$47,875.
That's the thing. Like, price wise, it's not. I think it's pretty much the same as BMW. Like, once you option it up the way you want it, you're like, they're both very expensive for what you're getting. That doesn't mean you shouldn't do it. As you know, I often argue on the other side of this, but I'm just pointing out that like this is not a great value compared to BMW. It's going to be about the same, like in the same ballpark.
Doesn't, of course it doesn't mention a 0-60 time. Why would it? I could swear
5.7 seconds.
Like
it's in the technical specifications.
Oh, there you go. I was going to say. Okay. I thought it was around 5.5.
I mean, like, that's good, but, like, is that like, $50,000 in 2017 good?
Mm, yeah. See, now I'm coming back to the Golf R. Let's see. Where is that?
You're too old for this car.
No, I'm not.
The Golf R? Yeah, you're too old for this.
No, I'm not. Our friend Brad has one, and it's not. He's not too old for it. We're all the same age, but
he pulls it off. We wouldn't pull it off.
You make a good point, actually.
he's also a lot cooler than us. He lives in California. Like he can pull that off. We can't.
You know, if you want to go two doors, speaking of jamming your kid in the back, the Accord Coupe does 0-60 in 5.6 seconds.
I do not want to go two door. What is the Volkswagen site not working for you, or am I bananas?
Volkswagen doesn't work for me.
Come out. Oh, stop you.
What about the last item on this list?
Which one is that?
The divorce option? Yep.
Yeah. It's just not. It's $100,000, Marco. I could buy two A4s.
What about a used Model S? You can get a used Model S for $50,000?
That's where things get interesting.
Buy it from MKBHD. I don't think he wants this anymore.
When you talk about maintenance costs, I would definitely not want to keep a Model S past the like big battery powertrain warranty, but I think that's 100,000 miles. So if you get one that's like right off lease, it's like 30-ish K miles, then it would probably need almost no work for like the next 5 years until you really wanted to, until the mileage started getting really high, and then you would probably trade it in for something else at that point. But because there are used Model S's, there aren't a lot of them because 3 years ago they weren't selling that many. So there aren't many of them to choose from, but they do come in. They are usually you have to call the dealer sometimes. Like they're not usually.
Well, no, they have a list.
Okay, there you go.
I put it in the chat. But the problem is there's no 90Ds, which is what you and underscore have, and I think would be a perfectly reasonable.
Well, the 90 has only existed for like a year and a half.
Okay, well, there you go.
So what you'd be looking at maybe would be the 85D, but all of the Ds, all of the dual model, the dual motor ones have only existed for, I think, about 2 years or so.
So the problem is I would want the dual motor for the acceleration, not because I necessarily need all-wheel drive.
It is better. I mean, and just in general, it's a much, the dual motor was a substantial improvement to the car, so you do
so
want that.
So P85D, the cheapest one they have is 80 grand. So I could buy...
That's the P model. That's the one that's new for like $130,000.
That's the first entry they have that has dual motor is the P85D for 80 grand with 15,000 miles.
That's kind of awesome.
What do you mean that's kind of awesome? It's $80,000.
Do you know how fast that is? That's the one that I test drove and I felt like it was getting smacked in the face and I said, no, this is too fast.
Like I understand that.
It was a P85D.
You're talking about, I could almost buy an A4 and a Golf R for one of these.
Yeah.
I can't justify
it. Or five Accords.
I can't justify it. I can't. I'm not saying
there's
you're
a
wrong,
70D
but...
on here for 67,000.
You could drive a different Accord on every day of the week.
Yeah. Oh my god, that 70D is a hideous color, though.
Yes, it is. Oh, like that weird, god. Like champagne-y. It's like you spilled some champagne into some snow slush.
I've seen more of the little mustache Model S's, and they've really grown on me, and now I like it better than the fish mouth.
What? Get out of here.
They look less hideous to me now, but they still look weird. Like I'm sure I'll, like, by the time it's time for me to renew my lease, I will be okay with it, but it's still weird right now.
Yeah, it's worse in white, obviously, right? But or in lighter colors, but it's turned me around having seen them. Now when I see one of the old ones, I go, ugh. I mean, I never really liked the big ball gag, but the pinch nose, the pinch nose looks better in real life than it does in photos.
Oh man, I disagree. I've seen it a couple times. It is not good.
The point is, whatever. This is a lot to choose from already, and because the dual model versions have only existed for like a year and a half or 2 years, there's probably about to be lots of them coming in, like in inventory, over the next year. It is certainly worth considering heavily. I'm not going to necessarily say that you should definitely do this, but it solves a lot of problems.
It solves a lot of problems.
It is faster than everything else you're looking at, first of all. It is way lower maintenance in all likelihood, especially like the newer you go. Like once you're into the D generation, they ironed out a lot of the early problems. And when you're still covered under the warranty, you know, that solves everything right there. You pay something like, I think it's like $500 a year for like this giant big inspection they do every year. But that's it. That's your entire total maintenance cost.
Until I need to spend $20,000 to replace all the batteries, because whatever one I'm hypothetically buying has between 15 and 30,000 miles on it.
I think it's like 10 years. It's really far into it. Basically, you don't really keep the car that long. That's the answer to that question.
You remember that I'm telling you that Aaron's car is 9.5 years old.
Almost everything you're looking at, all these picks, you're not going to keep those picks for 10 years. Like, not... None of them. You will own none of those when they are 10 years old.
Except for the Accord, obviously.
You will own none of those when they're 8 years old. How old is your car now? Like six or something? It's not even that old, right?
It was delivered to the original owner in December of 2010, if I remember right.
Yeah, so it's six. Mm-hmm. And it's already so expensive to maintain that you're trying to get rid of it.
Yeah, but that's because I didn't buy a boring Japanese car. That's the problem.
Right, and so my point is, you're going to have high maintenance costs on all of the cars in this list. Any car that you're going to be happy driving that's not going to crush your soul and ruin you as a person, you are going to have high maintenance costs if you want to keep it past year, like, you know, six or seven, basically, is probably about as far as you can go without things getting a little too crazy. You're going to have to pay a lot for every car. None of them are, like, particularly good investments or values. No matter how you own a car, you're going to pay a lot. Because you want a fast car, you're going to pay more. Simple as that. No matter how you slice it, no matter how you arrange it, no matter whether you buy new or used or lease, whether you get bitten by like bad maintenance luck like you did with this one or whether you don't, no matter what, there is no way to continuously drive fast cars without spending a ton of money on them. This is a place you have chosen to spend your money. You are an adult. You are a good person. You make a decent living. You can do that. It's totally fine. You don't indulge yourself in very many other things. This is what you do. It's okay.
This is the sound of the devil that's on Marco's shoulder.
I know,
all the time.
Right? You are the best, like, worst
it's
influence.
It's on both of his shoulders. He doesn't have an angel on one. It's just two little devils saying this to Marco constantly.
Yeah,
you are the best, worst, like, influence in the world.
Like, this matters a lot to you. You get a lot of joy out of this. You take a lot of your life happiness from driving a nice, fast car.
Which actually maybe makes me wonder if my priorities are screwed up, but I understand what you're saying.
Hey, look, everyone has something like this, you know? Be happy that yours is something relatively harmless like this and not like drugs or, you know, like a lot of people's vices are way worse than this.
Like drugs or Mac Pros.
Yeah, God forbid. I mean, on the plus side, I don't like expensive watches yet.
Yeah, but don't. Yeah, exactly. That's way worse.
Seriously, it could be so much worse. Just look at Marco.
Exactly. Like, it could be way worse. So what I'm saying basically is like
pens, for crying out loud.
So basically, like, what I'm saying is, Don't feel guilty that you like nice, fast cars, and don't try to talk yourself down from what you really want. Because a car, it's a long-term choice. You have to make this decision, and you have to be driving whatever you pick. That's going to be your car for the next at least few years. And so it matters a lot. You shouldn't talk yourself down out of, like, you know, Casey's self-doubt. Like, let your friends encourage you, at least this one. Don't listen to that one talking about something boring in Japanese. Listen to this friend encourage you.
Tell them to go test drive an A4. That's what I tell them to do.
No, I think that's fair. I think test driving A4 is reasonable. I think if I were a betting man, I'd probably get the Golf R because it's the least amount of compromise all in all. Basically, the only thing I'm compromising on is I don't really want a hatchback, although there is some convenience that comes from
That's a big thing.
But
interior quality is going to be worse than the A4 by a lot.
I don't think it'll be a lot. Now, I have not sat in a Golf in a long time, but people that are friends of mine that are also car nuts swear by Volkswagen interiors and by proxy Audi as well. I happen to like BMW interiors. I happen to like the way BMWs think because I think the same way. And I'm trying to figure out what a specific thing I can cite. I don't have any off the top of my head, but iDrive has always made sense to me, you know, stuff like that. But everything I've understood is that Volkswagen gets interiors right. You can debate the exteriors, you can debate a lot of things, but you can debate whether or not they make diesels that get more than 4 miles a gallon. But they do interiors right, from what I'm told. And I mean, I think the plan is, if I'm really serious about this, which I think I am, the plan is first to get Erin a car because she needs one worse and she's next in line. But after that, test drive a Golf R, test drive an A4, and that's probably the entire... I'd probably test drive a Focus ST just to see, but it's probably one of these.
So may I suggest an alternative?
Mm-hmm.
So you are prepared to spend probably $50,000 on a nice A4.
Potentially, yes. Potentially.
Okay. The A4 is pretty much what you have now. It's moving you to the newest version of what you're already driving with a different shape logo on the front. It is not an upgrade. It is not probably a downgrade in any meaningful way.
Slightly. It's going to be a little bit slower if that's where I end up.
Okay. So it's actually getting slower. Okay. Right. Okay. You're losing a couple cylinders, et cetera. Okay. That's about $50,000 to do that.
Mm-hmm.
For $55,000, you could have a brand new fully loaded M2.
Stop. Stop with that noise. The problem is the waiting list for an M2 is... The waiting list for an M2 is like 2 years. My car will be exploded by then.
Then get the M235i. Close enough. Look, BMWs are really nice cars when you don't have to pay to maintain them.
Well, that's true. But like, all I'm doing is punting my problem down the road. I'm kicking the can.
Yeah, so look, I mean, I know you. As much as I want you to drive a Tesla, I know that your left foot would fall off and you'd be upset. As much as I want you to have something nice and fast that is a little nice and fast in other ways, like, you know, your little, like, you know, GTI and R and Focus options, I can't let you do that. I just can't let you drive a hatchback. You're too old for that. You're dumb with that.
All right. You realize all of Europe, any age group,
it's
drives
different.
A hatchback.
Europe is different. California is different. We live here on the East Coast, and we are boring geeks in our 30s. You can't drive a hatchback.
I can drive a hatchback.
You have a kid, for Christ's sake. You can't. No. All right. So that's out. The A4 is a great car, I'm sure. Does it not have a six-cylinder option anymore? Is that... Not a
no,
thing.
It does not.
Okay, maybe when the S4 comes back, presumably.
Probably.
But
yes.
But that would then be more money than this, I bet. What you really want, in deep down in your heart, what you really want is a 6-speed rear-wheel drive BMW. And
it's well, I want it until the moment that that the warranty runs out, and then I need to get something different again.
If only there is a way to have a car where you're always under warranty.
Stop. God, the white M2 is hideous.
You get the blue one, right? I think you'd have to
get
the blue one.
Absolutely.
When I priced yours out here just now, I picked the blue one for you because I also think the white is hideous, and I think black is a little bit boring for that car. So yeah, I think blue is the only option for that car. You could also do the M240i. Which is very good in itself.
I've driven the M235. A friend at work has one, and it was phenomenal.
Rear-wheel drive M235 or M240i is only 46. It's like 10,000 less. That is interesting.
That's actually a pretty good compromise if I don't mind never being able to put Declan in the car.
I mean, you could. It's a two-door. Sure. It would suck. You could. But you wouldn't want this if you were, you know, going to do that a lot. But it really, what you would be happiest with is probably something like this. It's probably not settling for a Volkswagen Group-made hatchback. And the A4 would be fine, except it's pretty much a sideways step. It's you're getting what you already had and actually slightly slower because you're losing a couple cylinders. BMW makes good cars that you like a lot. They just suck to maintain.
You know, the thing that pisses me off, so I just priced my M2 and I came up with 55,202. Yeah. But the thing that really pisses me off about it, in the summary page, it says your M2 coupe, and there's, you know, a panoramic view that you can, well, a quasi-panoramic view of the car, and man, does it look good. But right under that, estimated lease, $829, MSRP is billed, 55,202. The next item on the list, 0-60, 4.1 seconds. Like, you get me, BMW. You really get me. I can't do another BMW. I'm so angry about it right now. I just can't. I'm over it.
Wait, cool off, run some numbers, and consider all your options, really. Like, don't rule anything out unless it wouldn't make you happy to drive. Then rule it out. So goodbye Accord, goodbye Mazda. Sorry.
Truth. I'm not sure the A4 would make me terribly happy, but it's worth a shot.
Right, exactly. You're actually getting slower than your current car. Like, this is what I'm saying. Like, when you've, during the good days of when you've been owning your wonderful white BMW, during these good days, were you ever thinking that your next car would be slower?
No, certainly not.
Right, exactly. You were thinking, man, this is a great car, and my next one's going to be even faster. You were thinking about getting an M3 next. And I totally agree with you that the current M3 is ridiculously expensive and is probably not the right move. And also, it sounds just disgusting. There's now finally enough of them in the world that I'm starting to like see and hear more of them in real life. My goodness, is that a hideous sounding car. But the M2 isn't. The M2 sounds nice and is kind of like what the M3 should be, but isn't. The M2 is a good car. I really think that you should consider it. And if not the M2, then the M240, which is it's also very good.
I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to get a coupe. It's not going to happen.
I mean, it's kind of like a sedan, just with two of the doors removed. But like, it's like you're riding at sedan height. You're not like on the floor like you are like in like an S2000. Like, you know, like you're riding at sedan height. You're roughly sedan shaped. You have similar like sedan weight distributions. Or say screw it and get an M3 and just be done with it and just never drive it near my house so I don't have to hear it.
Wow. There's no way I'd get an M3. No freaking way. Not a chance. I'm pretty much telling myself I will not buy another BMW, if ever, at least next. I'm just not going to do it.
Then you can get a worse car for you. That's fine. But
I'm telling, what is worse about a Golf R? What is worse?
The size, the refinement, the interior. The
only thing that's worse about the Golf is for people who hate hatchbacks. But
which
apparently Casey doesn't.
And no, so he hate them, but I don't like
them. Hatchbacks, and so like that eliminates my main objection to the Golf is that it's a hatchback. Every other aspect of it sounds like Casey would have fun with it, and he's somehow not bothered by driving around in a rabbit, so that's fine.
You're such a jerk.
No, Casey, look, you need to forgive yourself. Let yourself get something nice.
We need to forgive him for getting a hatchback. That's what we need to do.
He needs to forgive himself for getting a hatchback.
$40,472 for a brand new Golf R.
You could also, well, although if you do get that, we'll have to have like a seminar on how to pronounce the name of the car.
What are you a Golf person? What do you
mean? He keeps saying like the of Mexico, blank of Mexico. That's what he keeps saying, but that's not the name of the car. It's an O.
Aye.